My name is Ingrid Christiansen, and I will be reading a story tonight by Barbara Kingsolver called Quality Time. And we will be discussing the story, which will be my favorite part. Barbara Kingsolver is an author of The Bean Trees, which I haven't read, but Ruth, you've read?
Mm-hmm.
And Phyllis, have you read it? And they both recommend it highly, and I'm dying to read it because she's such a good writer. These are short stories, Homeland and other stories. And tomorrow I'm going to read Homeland because it's a very interesting and complicated story. But today I'm going to read Quality Time, which is a really nice little story. The back of the book says, Barbara Kingsolver grew up in eastern Kentucky and now lives in Tucson, Arizona with her husband and daughter. Her poetry and fiction have been published widely in journals and anthologies, and she has contributed articles and reviews to the New York Times and many other publications. She is currently at work on her second novel. And about this book, a little excerpt, a dazzling array of stories, Kingsolver's knowledge of human nature and especially domestic relationships is breathtaking. Fulfilling the promise of her highly praised and beloved first novel, Kingsolver gives us a rich and emotionally resonant collection of 12 stories. In Homeland, Kingsolver has spread her characters over an even wider landscape than in The Bean Trees, Northern California, Urban Southwest, Hills of Eastern Kentucky, the rural Midwest, and the Caribbean island of St. Lucia. In every setting, though, her distinctive voice rings true. These are stories of hope, momentary joy, and powerful endurance. With disarming honesty, at times comic but often heartrending, she explores the twin themes of family ties and the life choices one must ultimately make alone, while creating a world of love and possibility that readers will want to take as their own. I think the story I'm going to read, Quality Time, is a story about a single parent and her child. And I think it brings up some issues of parenting. So I thought I might mention some of those that I think this story raises up for us before I read it. One issue that it brings up for me is keeping your soul as a parent, by which I mean not being so consumed by it that you forget who you are as a human being. And I think it's, especially when your children are young or your child is young, it's very easy to do that. So you forget to have deep thoughts or to think in longer range than the next 6 hours at most. And she is struggling with that, getting beneath the surface of things. And so she looks into that question some, what gives meaning to her life and what allows her to have depth to it. It brings up, how are you honest with children? What about honesty with kids? She respects, the mother in the story respects the child a great deal and doesn't resort to baby talk, and it's nice to hear the language. Kingsolver has a very good ear for dialogue, and her dialogue changes quite dramatically from story to story. But in this one, the mother talks to that child, about a four-year-old, I think, with tremendous respect. And I think that's, to me, worth listening to. And the issue of a parent having a life. Having a life of their own, having friends and lovers and friendships and whatever that you need to have a life. Beauty. And then, so those are things that I think, in terms of issues of parenting, those are directions we could go once I've read the story and talk about those things. So at least those are some of the things. And then I think in the story itself, there are a couple of real interesting things. One is that she talks a lot about life as a deal or as chance or as coincidence. She uses the language of gaming and of chance in ways that I found fascinating. And then she also is exploring, which I imagine is a question for all of us in our lives, but I think more so for people who are parenting small children, questions of order and chaos. I don't think that the questions ever go away, at least for me. Order and chaos is more at risk for it at some times than others. But I have, at least in me, a constant awareness of the possibility of chaos in a way that I find really frightening. And I think she maybe does too. So with that, I will read you the story and then we can talk about it. It is a small story, but I think part of her skill as a story writer is that she can so successfully write a small, carve out a small bit of stuff to write about and write about it beautifully and well and tie it together very well. So we'll see whether you agree with me once we've heard the story. Quality time is a phrase that was more popular about 10, 15 years ago than it is now, maybe, but I think it's still trotted out a lot. It's a phrase that means you don't have to see your kids much as long as you really see them when you see them. And it's a disputed notion. Quality Time by Barbara Kingsolver. Miriam's one and only daughter, Rennie, wants to go to ice cream heaven. This is not some vision of the afterlife, but a retail establishment here on Earth, right in Barrymore Plaza, where they have to drive past it every day on the way to Rennie's daycare center. In Miriam's opinion, this opportunistic placement is an example of the free enterprise system at its worst. "Rennie, honey, we can't today. There just isn't time," Miriam says. She is long past trying to come up with fresh angles on this argument. This is the bland, simple truth. The issue is time, not cavities or nutrition. Rennie doesn't want ice cream. She wants an angel sticker for the Pearly Gates game, for which one only has to walk through the door, no purchase necessary. When you've collected enough stickers, you get a free banana split. Miriam has told Rennie over and over again that she will buy her a banana split some Saturday when they have enough time to make an outing of it. But Rennie acts as if this has nothing to do with the matter at hand, as though she has asked for a Cabbage Patch doll and Miriam is offering to buy her shoes. "I could just run in and out," Rennie says after a while. "You could wait for me in the car." But she knows she has lost. The proposition is half-hearted. "We don't even have time for that, Rennie. We're on a schedule today." Rennie is quiet. The windshield wipers beat a deliberate, ingratiating rhythm, sounding as if they feel put upon to be doing this job. All of Southern California seems dysfunctional in the rain. Cars stall, drivers go vaguely brain dead. Miriam watches Rennie look out at the drab scenery and wonders if, for her sake, they ought to live someplace with ordinary seasons. Piles of raked leaves in autumn, winters with frozen streams and carrot-nosed snowmen. Someday, Rennie will read about these things in books and think that they're exotic. They pass by a brand new auto mall, still under construction, though some of the lots are already open and ready to get down to brass tacks with anyone who'll brave all that yellow machinery and mud. The front of the mall sports a long row of tall pine palm trees, newly transplanted, looking frankly mortified by their surroundings. The trees depress Miriam. They were probably yanked out of some beautiful South Sea island and set down here in front of all these Plymouths and Subarus. Life is full of bum deals. Miriam can see that Rennie is not pouting, just thoughtful. She's an extremely obliging child, considering that she's just barely five. She understands what it means when Miriam says they are, quote, on a schedule. Today, they really don't have 2 minutes to spare. Their dance card, so to speak, is filled. When people remark to Miriam about how well organized she is, she laughs and declares that organization is the religion of the single parent. It sounds like a joke, but it isn't. Miriam is faithful about the business of getting each thing done in its turn, and could no more abandon her orderly plan than a priest could swig down the transubstantiated wine and toss out wafers like frisbees over the heads of those waiting to be blessed. Miriam's motto is that life is way too complicated to leave it to chance. But in her heart, she knows what a thin veil of comfort it is that she has wrapped around herself and her child to cloak them from chaos. It all hangs on the presumption that everything has been accounted for. Most days, Miriam is a believer. The road ahead will present no serious potholes, no detour signs looming sudden and orange in the headlights, no burning barricades thrown together as reminders that the world's anguish doesn't remain mute, like the tree falling in the forest, just because no one is standing around waiting to hear it. Miriam is preoccupied along this line of thought as she kisses Rennie goodbye and turns the steering wheel, arm over elbow, guiding her middle-aged Chevy out of the Tender Care parking lot and back onto the slick street. Her faith has been shaken by coincidence. On Saturday, her sister Janice called to ask if she would be the guardian of Janice and Paul's three children if the two of them should die. "We're redoing the wills," Janice reported cheerfully over the din, while in the background Miriam could plainly hear the words, "Give me that rainbow bright right now, dumb face." "Just give it some thought," Janice had said calmly, but Miriam hadn't needed to think. "Will you help out with my memoirs if I'm suddenly the president?" her sister might as well have asked, or, "What are your plans in the event of a nuclear war?" The question seemed to Miriam even more mythical than practical. Janice was a careful person, not given to adventure, and in any case tended to stick to those kids like some kind of maternal adhesive. Any act of God that could pick off Janice without taking the lot would be a work of outstanding marksmanship. Late on Saturday night, while Miriam was hemming a dress of Rennie's that had fallen into favor, she'd had a phone call from her ex-husband, Lute. His first cousin and her boyfriend had just been killed on the San Diego freeway by a Purolator van. Over the phone, Lute seemed obsessed with getting the logistics of the accident right, as though the way the cars all obeyed the laws of physics could make this thing reasonable. The car that had the blowout was a Chrysler. The cousin and boyfriend were in her Saab. The van slammed into them from behind. "They never had a chance," Lute said, and the words chilled Miriam. Long after she went to bed, she kept hearing him say, "never had a chance," and imagining the pair as children, as if even in infancy their lives were already earmarked. "These two will perish together in their 30s, in a Saab, wearing evening clothes, on their way to hear a friend play in the symphony orchestra." All that careful mothering and liberal arts education gone to waste. I used to think of that with my children, that if they would get killed, all my careful mothering would go to waste. And she said it here. And a liberal arts education to boot. Lute's cousin had been a freelance cellist, often going on the road with the likes of Barry Manilow and Tony Bennett and once Madonna. It was probably all much tamer than it sounded. Miriam is surprised to find she has opinions about this woman and a clear memory of her face. She only met her once at her own wedding, when all of Lute's family had come crowding around like fog. But now this particular cousin had gained special prominence. Her vague features crystallized in death, like a face on a postage stamp. Important, somebody you can't picture doing the humdrum silly things that life is made of, clipping her toenails or lying on the bed with her boyfriend watching Dallas. If you hold it clearly in your mind that she is gone. Lute is probably crushed. He idolized her. His goal in life is to be his own boss. Freelance husbanding was just one of the things that hasn't worked out for Lute. Freelance fathering he can manage. Miriam is thinking of Rennie while she waits through a yellow light she normally might have run. Rennie last week insisted on wearing only dresses to nursery school and her pale straight hair just so with a ribbon. They'd seen Snow White. Rennie as a toddler standing in her crib holding the rails, her mouth open wide with the simplest expectation you could imagine. A cookie, a game, or nothing at all. Just that they would both go on being there together. Lute was already out of the picture by that time. He wouldn't have been part of Rennie's hopes. It is only lately, since she'd learned to count, that Lute's absence matters to Rennie. On the Disney Channel, parents come in even numbers. The light changes and there is a honking of horns. Someone has done something wrong, or too slowly, or in the wrong lane. Miriam missed it altogether, whatever it was. She remembers suddenly a conversation she had with her sister years ago when she was unexpectedly pregnant with Rennie, and Janice was already a wise old mother of two. Miriam was frantic. She'd wanted a baby, but didn't feel ready yet. "I haven't really worked out what it is I want to pass on to a child," she'd said to Janice, who laughed. According to Janice, parenting was 3% conscious effort and 97% automatic pilot. It doesn't matter what you think you're going to tell them. What matters is that they're right there watching you every minute, while you let the lady with just two items go ahead of you in line, or when you lay on the horn and swear at the guy that cuts you off in traffic. There's no sense kidding yourself. What you see is what you get. Miriam had argued that people could consciously change themselves if they tried, though in truth she'd been thinking more of Lute than herself. She remembers saying a great many things about choices and value systems and so forth. A lot of first pregnancy high-mindedness, it seems to her now. Now she understands. Parenting is something that happens mostly while you're thinking of something else. Miriam's job claims her time for very irregular hours at the downtown branch of the public library. She is grateful that the people at Rennie's daycare don't seem to have opinions about what kind of mother would work mornings one day, evenings the next. When she was first promoted to this position, Miriam had a spate of irrational fears. She imagined Miss Joyce at Tender Care giving her a lecture on homemade soup and the importance of routine in the formative years. But Miss Joyce, it seems, understands modern arrangements. "The important thing is quality time," she once said to Miriam, in a way that suggested bedtime stories read with a yogic purity of concentration, a mind temporarily wiped clean of things like brake shoes and master charge bills. Miriam does try especially hard to schedule time for the two of them around Rennie's bedtime, but it often seems pointless. Rennie is likely to be absorbed in her own games, organizing animated campaigns on her bed with her stuffed animals, and finally dropping off to sleep in the middle of them, limbs askew, as though felled by a sniper. Today is one of Miriam's afternoon shift days. After leaving Rennie, she has 40 minutes in which she must do several errands before going to work. One of them is eat lunch. This is an item Miriam would actually put on a list. Water African violets, dry cleaners, eat lunch. She turns in at the burger boy and looks at her watch, surprised to see that she has just enough time to go in and sit down. Sometimes she takes the drive-through option and wolfs down a fish sandwich in the parking lot, taking large bites, rattling the ice in her Coke, unmindful of appearances. It's efficient, although it puts Miriam in mind of eating disorders. Once she is settled inside with her lunch, her ears stray for company to other tables, picking up scraps of other people's private talk. "More than 400 years old," she hears, "and it was a little bit tight over the instep, and they had to call the police to get him out of there." She thinks of her friend Bob, who is a relentless eavesdropper, though because he's a playwright, he calls it having an ear for dialogue. Gradually she realizes that at the table behind her, a woman is explaining to her daughter that she and Daddy are getting a divorce. It comes to Miriam like a slow shock, building up her nerve endings until her skin hurts. "This conversation will only happen once in that little girl's life, and I have to overhear it," Miriam is thinking. "It has to be here." The surroundings seem banal, so cheery and hygienic. So many wiped clean plastic surfaces. But then Miriam doesn't know what setting would be better. Certainly not some unclean place, and not an expensive restaurant either. That would be worse. To be expecting a treat only to be socked with this news. Miriam wants badly to turn around and look at the little girl. In her mind's eye, she sees Rennie in her place, small and pale, sunk back into the puffy pink of her goose-down jacket like a loaf of risen dough that's been punched down. The little girl keeps saying, "Okay," no matter what her mother tells her. "Daddy will live in an apartment and you can visit him. There's a swimming pool." "Okay." "Everything else will stay the same. We'll keep Peppy with us and you'll go on to your same school." "Okay." "Daddy still loves you, you know." "Okay." Miriam is thinking that ordinarily this word would work. It has finality. When you say it, it closes the subject. It's already dark by the time Miriam picks up Rennie at Tender Care after work. The headlights blaze accusingly against the glass doors as if it were very late, midnight even. But it's only 6:30, and Miriam tries to cheer herself by thinking that if this were summer, it would still be light. It's a trick of the seasons, not entirely her fault, that Rennie has been abandoned for the daylight hours. She always feels more surely on course when her daughter comes back to her. Rennie bounces into the car with a sheaf of papers clutched in one fist. The paper they use at Tender Care is fibrous and slightly brown and seems wholesome to Miriam, like turbinado sugar rather than refined. "Hi, sweetie, I missed you today." Miriam leans over to kiss Rennie and buckle her in before pulling out of the parking lot. All day she has been shaky about driving, and now she dreads the trip home. All that steel and momentum, it doesn't seem possible that soft human flesh could travel through it and come out intact. Throughout the day, Miriam's mind has filled spontaneously with images of vulnerable things. Baby mice, sunburned eyelids, sea creatures without their shells. "What did you draw?" she asks Rennie, trying to anchor herself. This one is you and me and loot," Rennie explains. Miriam is frowning into the river of moving headlights, waiting for a break in the traffic, and feels overcome by sadness. There are so many things to pay attention to at once, and all of them so important. "You and me and loot," Miriam repeats. "Uh-huh, and a dog, Pickles, and Leslie Copley and his mom. We are all going for a walk." A sports car slows down, letting Miriam into the street. She waves her thanks. "Would you like to go for a walk with Leslie Copley and his mom sometime?" "No, it's just a picture." "What would you like for supper?" "Pot pies," Rennie shouts. Frozen dinners are her favorite thing. Miriam rather likes them too, although this isn't something she'd admit to many people. Certainly not her mother, for instance, or to Bob, who associates processed foods with intellectual decline. She wonders, though, if her privacy is an illusion. Rennie may well be revealing all the details of their home life to her nursery school class, opening new chapters daily. "What I had for dinner last night, what Mom does when we run out of socks." They probably play games along these lines at Tender Care with entirely innocent intentions, and other games too, games with a social worker bent. What things make you happy or sad? What things make you feel scared? Miriam smiles. Rennie is fearless. She does not know how it feels to be hurt, physically or otherwise, by someone she loves. The people at Tender Care probably hear a lot worse than pot pies. "Mom," Rennie asks, "does God put things on the TV?" "What do you mean?" Rennie considers. "The cartoons and the movies and things, does God put them there?" "No, people do that. You know how Grandpa takes movies of you with his movie camera and then we show them on the screen? Well, it's like that. People at the TV station make the programs and then they send them out onto your TV screen." "I thought so," Rennie said. "Do you make them sometimes at the library?" Miriam hears a siren, but can't tell where it's coming from. "Well, I organize programs for the library, you're right, but not TV programs. Things like storybook programs. You remember, you've come to some of those." Miriam hopes she doesn't sound irritated. She's trying to slow down and move into the right lane because of the ambulance, but people keep passing her on both sides, paying no attention. It makes Miriam angry. Sure enough, the ambulance is coming their way. It has to jerk to a full stop in the intersection ahead of them because of all of the people who refuse to yield to greater urgency. "Mom, what happens when you die?" Miriam is startled because she was thinking of Lute's poor cousin, thinking of the condition of the body, to be exact. But Rennie doesn't even know about this relative and won't hear her sad story for years to come. "I'm not sure, Rennie. I think maybe what happens is that you think back over your life about all the nice things you've done and the people who've been your friends. And then you close your eyes and it's quiet." She was going to say, "and go to sleep." But she's read that sleep and death shouldn't be equated and that it can cause children to fear bedtime. "What do you think?" I think you put on your nicest dress, and then you get in this glass box, and everybody cries, and then the prince comes and kisses you on the lips. That's what happened to Snow White, isn't it? Uh-huh. I didn't like it when he kissed her on the lips. Why didn't he kiss her on the cheek? Well, grown-ups kiss on the lips when they like each other. But Snow White wasn't a grown-up. She was a little girl. This is a new one on Miriam. The whole conversation is like a toboggan ride, threatening at every moment to fly out of control in any direction. She's enjoying it, though, and regrets that they will have to soon stop for some errands. They are low on produce, canned goods, aluminum foil, and paper towels, completely out of vacuum cleaner bags and milk. What I think, said Miriam, after giving it some consideration, is that Snow White was a little girl at first, but then she grew up. Taking care of the seven dwarfs helped her to learn responsibility. Responsibility is something she and Rennie have talks about from time to time. She hears another siren, but this one is definitely behind them, probably going to the same scene as the first. She imagines her sister Janice's three children bundling into her life in a whirlwind of wants and possessions. Miriam doesn't even have time for another houseplant, but she realizes that having time is somehow beside the point. So when the prince kissed her, did she grow up? Rennie asks. No, before that. She was already grown up when the prince came, and they liked each other, and they kissed, and afterward they went out for a date. Like you and Mr. Bob? Like Bob and I do sometimes, right. You don't have to call him Mr. Bob, honey. He's your friend, and you can call him just Bob if you want to. Instead of making the tricky left turn into the shopping center, Miriam's car has gone right, flowing with the tide of traffic. It happened almost before she knew it, but it wasn't an accident. She just isn't ready to get to the grocery store where this conversation will be lost among the bright distractions of bubblegum and soda. Looping back around the block will give them another 4 or 5 minutes. They could sit and talk in the parking lot out of the traffic, but Miriam is starting to get her driving nerves back. And besides, Rennie would think that peculiar. Her questions would run on another track. And then, what happened to the seven dwarfs? Rennie wants to know. I think Snow White still took care of them until they were all grown up and could do everything by themselves. And did the prince help too? I think he did. But what if Snow White died? If she stayed dead, I mean, after the prince kissed her. Miriam now understands that this is the angle on death that has concerned Rennie all along. She is relieved. For Miriam, practical questions are always the more easily answered. I'm sure the dwarfs would still be taken care of, she says. The point is that Snow White really loved them, so she'd make sure someone was going to look after them, no matter what, don't you think? Uh-huh. Maybe the prince. Maybe. A motorcyclist dodges in front of them, too close, weaving from lane to lane just to get a few yards ahead. At the next red light, they will all be stopped together, the fast drivers and the slow, shooting looks at one another as if someone had planned it all this way. Rennie, if something happened to me, you'd still have somebody to take care of you. You know that, don't you? Uh-huh, Lute. Is that what you'd like, to go and live with Lute? Would I have to? No, you wouldn't have to. You could live with Aunt Janice if you wanted to. Rennie brightens. Aunt Janice and Uncle Paul and Michael and Donna and Perry? The way she says it makes Miriam think of their Christmas card. Right. Is that what you'd want? Rennie stares at the windshield wipers. The light through the windshield is spotty, falling with an underwater strangeness on Rennie's serious face. I'm not sure, she says. I'll have to think it over. Miriam feels betrayed. It depresses her that Rennie is even willing to take the question seriously. She wants her to deny the possibility, to give her a tearful hug and say she couldn't live with anyone but Mommy. It's not like I'm sending you away, Rennie. I'm not going to die while you're a little girl. We're just talking about what if. You understand that, right? Right, says Rennie. It's a game. We play what if at school. After another minute, she says, I think Aunt Janice. They are repeating their route now, passing again by the burger boy where Miriam had lunch. The tables and chairs look neater than it is possible to keep things in real life, and miniature somehow, like doll furniture. It looks bright and safe, not the sort of place that could hold ghosts. On an impulse, Miriam decides to put off the errands until tomorrow. She feels reckless, knowing that tomorrow will already be busy enough without a backlog. Do you like that? No, pot pies. And no ice cream heaven? I don't need any more angel stickers. Leslie Copley gave me 12. Well, that was nice of him. Yep, he hates bananas. Okay, we'll go straight home. But do you remember that pot pies take half an hour to cook in the oven? Will you be too hungry to wait once we get home? No, I'll be able to wait, Rennie says, sounding as if she really will. In the overtones of her voice and the way she pushes her blonde hair over her shoulder, there is a startling maturity, and Miriam is frozen for a moment with a vision of a much older Rennie. All the different Rennies, the teenager, the adult, are already contained in her hands and her voice, her confidence. For moments like these, parents can find the courage to believe in the resilience of their children's lives. They will barrel forward like engines, armored by their own momentum, more indestructible than love. Okay then, pot pies it is, Miriam says. Okay. How does it make you feel? What's your first reaction?
I really like all the images that it creates in my mind. I mean, I can really, really feel everything that's going on and see it. It's like in there. Like being in the car the whole time and yet drifting off into your own world and thinking about all these different things and all the little subplots.
It's very sharp. It's very clear. Mm-hmm. The subplots are interesting. How many stories within the story would you guess? Mm-hmm. I started adding them up today and I realized I hadn't gotten them all. There's the Snow White, there's the dead cellist cousin, there's
Bob.
Divorce
and restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Games at Tender Care.
Yes.
The divorce at Burger Boy is what you said, isn't it?
The ice
cream place. And something about movies. What was there about movies?
Did God make?
Oh yeah, right. Did God make movies in the whole?
Ambulance.
Yeah.
What?
The ambulance.
The ambulance. Exactly. And you never know.
Right. It's a lot of suspense there.
Yeah, and it sort of worries you.
Yeah,
it's a little
right.
Fear
yeah.
of chaos
yeah.
again.
And the sister and the kids.
And the sister and the children.
Mm-hmm.
It's another whole possibility of what could happen, and it's a sort of a story within a story.
I feel kind of overwhelmed by the largeness of the task, the dailiness of it all.
It's one day. This is part of one day. It's the ride, basically the ride to and from daycare.
Yeah.
And how you can have these plans about parenting, but you meet them moment by moment by moment, not from the scope of a big plan.
I also felt a kind of warmth that this was a mother that was so interested in this conversation that she wanted to go around another block so that it wouldn't be interrupted somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something that she really appreciated somehow.
Mm-hmm. How did you think the relationship was?
Between mother and child?
Mm-hmm.
Open.
Now, here's the quality time of the title is going on in this conversation in the car, and she doesn't want it to end.
And yet in the car, at the same time is the fear of an accident, because she has just been told of an accident. There's the rain, there's the LA freeway, there's the steel hurtling through space with the tender people inside it.
Those images of vulnerability, the
baby mice.
Sunburned islands.
Yeah, weren't those incredible? She can just, she packed so much into this.
I'm always impressed by writers like her who can describe something so typical in such a wonderful way, and you think, oh yeah, you know, that, like you were saying, you know, it happens to us too, but we don't think of it in these words, and her words are so specific.
But realistic sounding to me.
Yeah.
The dialogue, I thought, was very accurately represented and rang true. I noticed when I was reading it this time that on the way to daycare, or earlier in the story, she said that she could no more abandon her orderly plan than a priest could swig down the transubstantiated wine and toss out wafers like frisbees over the heads of those waiting to be blessed. Now that's at the bottom of page 2. And on the last page, she feels reckless, knowing that tomorrow will already be busy enough without a backlog. But on an impulse, Miriam decides to put off the errands until tomorrow. So something has changed. I mean, she knows that she has to. So what do you think that's all about? I mean, she obviously didn't put that in as an accident.
I think the chance of life, the cousin's death, and the thoughts of her sister possibly dying, although she doesn't think it's likely, and probably, you know, and probably the thought crossing her mind of her dying.
In fact, discussing her death.
Right, and that probably shook up her orderliness a little bit and decided the quality time was probably more important than the schedule.
Mm-hmm, good.
Well, I think that organization is the religion of the single parent is wonderful. I mean, it's very believable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not a single parent, but I have no difficulty believing that. so that to disrupt that is really major. Having to disrupt all the careful organization of every day and moment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then she says, after that, right after the Frisbees, she says, Miriam's motto is that life is way too complicated to leave to chance. But in her heart, she knows what a thin veil of comfort it is that she's wrapped around herself and her child to cloak them from chaos.
The day has been filled with all of these references to death. You know, the sister's call and the ambulance, which forces her to think of her own possible death and child being abandoned.
It seems if that had happened to me, if I had been the same at the beginning of this story as I was at the end of the day, I would not have given up my routine. That I would have stuck to it and I would have done what I planned and bought those groceries and gone to Burger Boy.
But it was the child who wanted to go home and have pot pies. And I think it was, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but I think it was her wish to honor that rather than to force the child to go through her list as she goes through the store, like the child in the restaurant was forced about the list of its life. You know, it would now be in this nursery school, and or that would stay the same, and the child was saying, okay. And I think she just wanted to do what the little girl wanted to do at that point, and gave up her own slight grasp on order in order to accommodate that. I don't know.
I think you're probably right.
It's subtle.
Yeah, it is subtle. The last word in the story is okay.
Mm-hmm. It has to do with that okay list business.
Uh-huh.
possibly it's that life is unpredictable, and there's images of things intruding into our order. And at the end it ends with, yes, life is unpredictable, and it can be unpredictable to a positive end. I mean, you can be spontaneous and change your plans, and conveying that to the child, that yes, life is, or she had seen images of unpredictable, you know, negative unpredictableness, but this was an unpredictable positive, and life is unpredictable.
Huh, that's interesting, yeah. And the fact that she had deviated already from her routine by deciding not to stop when she ordinarily would have stopped, partly out of fear of the traffic, but partly because, mostly because she wanted to continue the conversation.
And she had gotten back a little of her confidence. What was that line? There was some kind of elusive confidence that had come back to her.
She felt afraid to drive because of the fear of an accident, because of the phone call from her ex-husband. But then it does say that toward the end that she got, she had some of her driving confidence back.
And it was partly because she wanted to continue this conversation, so she took control of the traffic and decided to go around the block, keep this going.
And took control of the quality time.
Yeah.
She didn't find herself in the wrong lane like she did earlier.
See, I have a feeling that where I think where all this is maybe leading to is that you can take more risks when you feel better about yourself. And when you feel more in control. And when you're less afraid of the chaos and you have a sense more that you're rooted down and centered. Then it doesn't matter what actually, whether you have milk or not, or, you know, you can manage. Mm-hmm. It's only when you can't, when you're feeling closer to the edge, that you need to really nail everything into place. And she does say, as soon as Rennie gets in the car with her, she says she always feels more rooted when, what are the words she uses? She always feels more surely on course when her daughter comes back to her. And so maybe that plus the conversation being so meaningful and good, and her driving going okay, gives her enough self-control and self-confidence that she can throw caution to the winds a little bit. At least that's the way I felt about it. Does that ring true? Does that make sense?
I think, and maybe this is kind of far-fetched, but I think that something that might be giving her confidence is her daughter, because her daughter is almost introducing order to her. She's the one who doesn't want, you know, the treat of going to the ice cream store, or going out for dinner or whatever, wants to go home, wants to make the pot pies. It's gonna take a half an hour, but it's okay because it almost seems more orderly to me. And once she gets in the car, then she starts to feel better. And she's the one who wants to know about, you know, well, if you die, then is someone gonna take care of me? You know, she wants that order in her life, so she knows that. And gets that settled, and then moves on in the conversation to say that she just wants to go home. So.
Very interesting, yeah.
And also the daughter, I think at the very end where it says that she, you know, she sees this maturity in her, and that the daughter is going to go through life with her own momentum, with something like, with momentum stronger than love, or something like no matter what she could do, the daughter's going to somehow make it anyway.
They will barrel forward like engines, armored by their own momentum, more indestructible than love. Okay, then. Pot pies it is, Miriam says. Okay.
That is okay. It's interesting, because there's that earlier conversation about the divorce, and then okay, the child again.
Yeah, the contrast between the two mother-daughter situations is sharp, because in the divorce case, the daughter is completely passive and just saying, okay, okay. And here at the end, as you point out, the daughter is, in a sense, taking control of her own decisions, and it's the mother who says, okay.
Yeah.
And it's final this time, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the Burger Boy, she was noticing that okay didn't have that the finalization that it normally carries.
Sounded final, but wasn't.
And then it's the last thing that finalized the story.
Well, Joan, you were resonating with the story a lot at the beginning, and then something happened. Mm-hmm. as a fairly recent single mom, it seemed like it meant a lot to you, and then maybe you don't want to comment on...
Well, that's interesting. I never think about it.
Yeah.
I think that's an accurate observation. But I don't know at what point I lost it.
She's funny, don't you think? She is funny in ways, I mean, sort of subtly, but... I mean, I can't believe that I think that line is funny about the liberal arts education and good parenting, but I do.
That's what makes it funny, though, too, is a lot of the lines that are in there, you know that you've thought before, and it's almost like, you know, why didn't I write that down somewhere?
Now, are the Cinderella references in there in part to indicate this kind of growing, or Snow White, excuse me, of the maturation in a certain sense of the daughter, that she is, the mother recognizes her, like Snow White has grown up, as she explains it. She sees her little daughter becoming grown up in these ways that she's taking, making decisions. About the pot pies.
She talked about how the daughter looks several different ages for her in that moment. And the Snow White story is very interesting because the daughter has a couple of fears that she brings out in that.
Yeah.
What do you think they are?
The dating and then the death.
Who's going to care for
the dwarves?
Well, she's, yes, that's right.
Something about kissing.
Well, I think the kissing part is pretty important. She goes, yeah. She spends a lot of time investigating that. Do you remember what that is? Anybody? She wants to know whether Snow White is a child when she's kissed. Yeah. And she thinks she is a child. She thinks of Snow White as a child. And she said, well, why does he kiss her on the mouth? Mm-hmm. And the mother says, by the time he kisses her on the mouth, she's grown up. And she grew up through responsibility, caring for the seven dwarfs. But the kid does not want Snow White kissed by some man on the mouth because she thinks Snow White is a child, which I thought was quite a sensitive concern on the part of the child. But I mean, it's
that fascinating five-year-old wisdom. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, there's part of me that says this child sounds older than five, but I had one like that, and it's not older than five. I mean,
In fact, it could be four.
They have perceptions that are incredible, and you just wish that as you grow older, you didn't lose the ability to see things that way. Wonderful.
I can remember my son as a three-year-old sitting in the back seat of the car with his, you know, they sit in these little chairs like this, kind of in the car, strapped in. And all of a sudden, just out of the blue, he said, Grandma just works all the time. And this is after my grandmother View had died at age 99. And I said, why do you say that? And she said, well, she's even working now that she's dead. And I said, why do you say that? Well, she's making earth. Where does this stuff come from out of these kids? You know, it's just. But they do. At age 3, 4, and 5, they think a lot about death. Yeah. And they also, I think a lot about sex and the propriety of sex. So, or at least the ones that I've known have. And so to me, the conversation, I wonder the same thing, is this an appropriate age?
But yeah.
Yeah, I think it is too.
Maybe the kid who gave her the 12 ice cream stickers tried to kiss her in exchange.
Leslie, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
Trying to avoid it.
What about drawing the picture of the family? She drew a picture of herself, her father, her mother, and Leslie and his mother. We don't know whether Leslie has a father that's in the picture, but we know that her father is not much in the picture. And the mother very calmly says, would you like to go for a walk with Leslie and his mother? She doesn't take the bait.
The question she was avoiding.
Yeah.
Had to do with loot.
Yes. But then immediately after that it says that she feels terrible.
Yeah.
She goes through some feeling bad. And I don't know whether I mean, how much to make of her drawing that picture. But I'm sure that the mother made something of it in her mind.
There's a comment in there, you know, with routine and always staying on schedule, and then she gets angry when people do not stop the routine for the ambulance. For her, there's a limit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, you know, and I feel that way. That was one line that hit me. Yes, I get angry when I see people just going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well then, what about the role of serendipity or chance? Or did you pick up on that at all?
I thought it was really interesting when she said she pictured the two that got killed from the time they were children, you know, like destined to be killed in their, you know, fancy clothing, going to a symphony concert in their 30s. You know, and I wondered at the end when she saw the maturity in her daughter and saw her at different ages, how that kind of your chance in life from the time you're little is kind of in a straight trajectory.
I connected those same two scenes in my mind, and I don't know why, but I almost had the feeling that her seeing her daughter as a teenager and as a young woman, I wondered if she could take that as a guarantee that her daughter's destiny would not have ended before then. But I something about the way those two scenes were written, I connected them in my mind too. I don't know exactly why. But listen,
when you say that, even the momentum, you know, it's that same kind of the car accident, you know, it's that move being pushed forward somehow.
And also, like, Snow White taking the question about Snow White dying before, and I see the daughter of Snow White taking care of her mother, you know, and growing up, you know, and, you know, what even happens to the little girl if she would die? For the dwarfs in her mom.
I think the comments that you all have made about the daughter taking care of the mother have all been extremely insightful and true somehow in the way this works. The end of about half of the first eight paragraphs ends in words like, life is full of bum deals, a deal, which is a card game kind of phrase. Life is way too complicated to leave to chance. Her faith has been shaken by coincidence, which is a sentence I don't understand. I've looked at that sentence many times and I don't get it in the context of the story. The paragraph is, Miriam is preoccupied along this line of thought as she kisses Rennie goodbye and turns the steering wheel, arm over elbow, guiding her middle-aged Chevy out of the tender care parking lot and back into the slick street. Her faith has been shaken by coincidence. It's the only sentence in the story that I don't get.
Is it the car accident and the coincidence of the sob and the, you know, their lives going in this way and the life of the driver of the truck going that way and the blowout tire?
Could be.
Was it a Chevy that had blown?
I think it was a Chevy.
Was it the coincidence of the sister's call asking if they'll take care of the children in case they die and then... Did she just learn then about the
She learns after that about the accident, yeah. and her ex-husband Lute makes a point of the laws of physics. All the cars obeyed the laws of physics, so it wasn't left to chance.
But the call about the will, and then the news about the car accident. Isn't that the coincidence that they happened
Oh, right.
Together?
Both those things had happened before this, and she was just thinking about them.
Oh, okay.
Well, so, how does the car lot with the palm trees get into that?
Yeah.
Because have that's incomplete. The car lot's incomplete. So she's trying to say something there, and I don't know what that is.
And with those pine trees plunked down in front of it off some South Sea Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a car bazaar. It's a car lot of many different car companies, all selling cars there, only in Los Angeles. I don't know. What do you think she was saying with that?
I really don't know. But it's
something
in my mind that there's some connection between that and the car accident.
And the fact that she, and this whole story takes place in a car.
It might be a symbol for human beings trying to force certain things onto natural surroundings. I mean, you pick up trees from a totally different environment and force them into this artificial one. And that's what we do with our lists. You know, there is a natural momentum, that a natural force going on all the time, and we try to force some kind of order or stasis onto it, and it doesn't work very often.
Well, she's a writer who has, who's very fine-tuned to visual stuff and the idiosyncratic, because in her other stuff, you're constantly encountering idiosyncratic things. I mean, just, I'm not sure that I read any particular significant heavy symbolism into those three palm trees in the middle of the parking lot, but it, just because I've read some of her other stuff, and it's just, she's just got a, you know, how some people have an eye for detail, for, she's got an eye for the idiosyncratic, and it's just part of what gives her writing character, I think. Mm-hmm.
But it's also true that the car parking, I mean, the car sales establishment is something she keeps driving by, mm-hmm. and it's the same category of establishment as the Burger Boy establishment. Mm-hmm. The Burger Boy feeds her, and the whole story takes place in a car on a freeway packed with cars, and the freeway is fed, sort of, by this place that sells cars. I mean, there is something about that's the source of much of what the vehicle for this story. I don't know if that works or not, but.
And then there's Ice Cream Heaven, like another omen of death.
Those are the three business places, Ice Cream Heaven, the car place, and the burger
place. I wonder about the freeway as kind of another place pushing forward. I mean, once she got in the wrong lane and was, you know, pulled off, although she had meant to be in the, you know, another lane, and so that might be like a chance, or, you know, life kind of takes you in a direction you don't want to go, or I don't know how to work the ambulance in there, but, you know, like people getting your way or something.
Well, Ruth, you're probably right.
In her other novel, you're bopping along in her other novel, and you pass this Jesus is Lord used tire sales place.
I've heard about that.
I mean, it's just the idiosyncratic. It's the ordinary, and then that little twist that she gives things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this place was built by this huge Jesus is Lord sign, and so then they just used it to identify. I mean, it's just...
I mean, I love that stuff because it's just sort of the unexpected that you're, I mean, it's that little twist. And she does that with humor through all of her stuff. I mean, it's, her humor is idiosyncratic humor. Mm-hmm. It's very refreshing. I mean, I do think that she writes with a great deal of intentionality and weaves a lot of things together, but I'm a little bit resistant to want to bring too many.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Too serious an analysis. Yeah.
Joan, you've got something you're about to say.
No, I'm going to vote for it having just the meaning that you said of the trees being uprooted and out of place and replanted there in an artificial and kind of pointless, useless world. Commercialism at its worst. And she said that about the ice cream place, but it applies to the tacky car place as well. And having to have moments of quality time when you're commuting between the daycare center and home and stopping to pick up things is unnatural. You ought to be able to sit in the rainforest under the palm trees and just keep talking about things that are important and not have to be uprooted.
And
I think I lost the story because it's not a story to me, it's my life, and I was just tired about halfway through, and I had to check out. I mean, that's what I live when I'm not at Holden Village.
Connected with that point you just made is the fact that she gets some comfort and value out of the fact that her daycare center uses paper that's fibrous and a little brown and uses turbinado sugar instead of refined sugar. You know, it's all, you sort of take your comfort where you can get it, and it's not enough when you're parenting a young child, especially single parenting.
what was the name of the daycare?
Tender Care.
Remember at the beginning, she wasn't sure if she was ready to have this child, but it seems like they have such a close relationship at the end, she just couldn't imagine not having this child.
Yeah.
I mean, it would just have been, it's like, how could I ever have thought like that?
It seems to me she has plenty of wisdom to give to the child, too.
Yeah.
I think our time is up, but thanks for your indulgence. This was great. I learned a lot from you all tonight, and I enjoyed it. Thank you.